From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect Weekend. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Teich. Today on the program, as Republicans debate the proposed replacement for the ACA, a Democrat explains why she thinks it shouldn't be replaced at all.
Then we hear an essay from a Milwaukee native as she prepares for her journey on the Appalachian Trail.
This new bag is blue, and it has all sorts of straps and buckles. Most importantly, the bag has a purpose, to keep Lauren alive.
An 86-year-old Grafton man shares the chilling story of the day the Germans marched into town before World War II.
Grafton was quite notorious for that very reason. And whether that's good or bad, I don't know, but it's one of the things that we're known for. Whether we want to be known for it or not, it's history, so.
Plus, we'll have the latest episode of our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. Lake Effect Weekend is next, after the news.
Good afternoon. This is Lake Effect Weekend on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich.
And I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Since the passage of the Affordable Care Act in 2010, Republican politicians have vowed to repeal and replace the landmark legislation also known as Obamacare.
They announced their plan last week. It is called the American Health Care Act, or Trump Care, and it's found critics on both sides of the aisle. Some have referred to it as Obamacare Lite, while others say it fails to protect the nation's most vulnerable people.
A report out this past week from the Congressional Budget Office found that the bill would leave 24 million people without care over the next decade.
Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin has been a public advocate for health care reform for nearly two decades and has already come out strongly against the new bill. The Democrat spoke this week with Lake Effect's Joy Powers about why health care is such an important issue to her.
My reason for getting service many, many years ago was seeing way too many Americans left behind by our healthcare system. And as somebody who was uninsured in my childhood because of a pre-existing health condition, this is a battle that I've taken on for many years. We've made steps forward with health reforms, including the Affordable Care Act. And now President Trump, who on the campaign trail promised insurance for everybody, is breaking that promise, putting millions of people at risk of losing their health care coverage, and also in this plan, this Trump care plan, forcing millions to pay more for less care.
So you said that you had a pre-existing condition as a child, which kept you from getting health care even though you were a kid. What was that pre-existing condition?
You know, I had a serious childhood illness at age 9. It was similar to spinal meningitis. It was not exactly that diagnosis, but it put me in the hospital for 3 months. And despite the fact that I fully recovered, my grandparents who raised me were unable to get insurance at any price because I had had this previous illness. And I didn't have health insurance until I was in college and there was a group plan that I could enroll in. I felt that this was so unfair, especially to the parents and grandparents out there who worry about the health and well-being of their children, but also worry about the fact that an injury or an illness could lead them into medical bankruptcy. And so it's been an issue that I feel passionately about, and I thought it was so important when we fought for and won the reform in the Affordable Care Act that says insurance companies can't reject you because you have a pre-existing health condition. They must cover you, and that coverage must be affordable and comprehensive. And these hard-fought and won reforms are being torn back by Trump Care. It really puts insurance companies back in charge and lets them raise deductibles and charge higher premiums. And a lot of other harmful things are contained in Trump Care.
Now, when we say torn back, especially when we're talking about children with pre-existing conditions, what kind of rights are being sort of stripped in the Trump Care plan?
Right. So the President Trump and the Republicans will try to tell you that pre-existing conditions are still covered under their plan. However, they have written in a lot of provisions that make that far from a certainty. And let me explain. If there's an interruption in somebody's health insurance, so if they have a pre-existing condition, and then there's an interruption in their paying the premiums for their health care, they actually can be rejected, and certainly this frees up insurance companies to charge higher premiums and higher deductibles for people with pre-existing conditions. So if you say they're guaranteed access, but they can't afford it, is that truly a guarantee?
Yeah. You've been particularly concerned about seniors. What about this health care bill makes them so vulnerable?
Well, first of all, I'm not sure that people who are in their 50s and early 60s necessarily even think of themselves as seniors, but middle-aged and older Americans who are not yet eligible for Medicare face very, very sizable increases in their premiums and deductibles. The Affordable Care Act had some guarantees that prevented people being charged excessive amounts due to just their age. This pulls those back, that loosens those restrictions, and now people 50 and older are going to be able to be charged much higher premiums and deductibles. So this is a big concern. Also, the entire plan hastens the insolvency of Medicare. And that is, again, a big concern as seniors, people 65 and older, rely on Medicare for needed healthcare services.
So we're looking at estimates right now from the Congressional Budget Office saying that around 14 million will lose their coverage in the first year, with an additional 10 million losing coverage over the next decade. Do we know what those numbers look like for Wisconsin? How is Trump Care going to impact specifically Wisconsinites?
Well, we can certainly do some extrapolation from the national figures that the Congressional Budget Office came up with yesterday. But what I will say is this is heartbreaking to think about the fact that we have made so much progress in reducing the level of uninsurance in our nation. And the Congressional Budget Office estimates that if Trump Care passes, we will almost double the number of uninsured, the percentage of uninsured in our country. And so we can, I think, extrapolate the same for the state of Wisconsin. And in the days to come, I think we'll have more specific information about how it will impact people in our state. But just know that the news is really dire for those who have struggled to afford insurance coverage. And I can tell you that the people of Wisconsin did not send me to Washington to take away people's health care. And I won't support repealing the guaranteed health insurance protections and care that people have today. So I am strenuously opposing this Trump Care plan.
You know, what do you say to some Republicans, like your former colleague in the House, Paul Ryan, who believe this bill will really encourage people to take ownership of their health care?
You know, today people must take ownership of their health care. There is definitely a commitment that each individual and family needs to make. But before the passage of the Affordable Care Act, insurance was often totally out of reach in terms of cost or denied individuals altogether because of pre-existing health conditions that they might have had. And so we have come so far in granting affordable access to quality coverage through the passage of the Affordable Care Act. I would be the first to say it wasn't perfect and needed to be strengthened, but repealing it and with this wholly inadequate Trump Care replacement is not the direction to go.
There are some politicians who seem to have taken issue with the different things that have to be included in these affordable health care plans. And they kind of want to go to a more a la carte version of health care. What would that mean for people with pre-existing conditions, people who are sick?
It runs completely counter to the whole idea and concept of insurance to begin with. The idea with insurance is that we all put in against the risk that any one of us might get sick with an illness that requires care and treatment that it might be expensive, or that we might be injured and need to seek emergency medical care and follow-up care. And it requires that the healthy put into that insurance pool, just like those who have pre-existing conditions. The more you take the healthy out of the pool, the insurance pool, the care and insurance coverage for those who are, have chronic conditions, who are older, et cetera, become exorbitant and unaffordable. And remember, if we don't have people with health insurance, it does ultimately come back to the taxpayers. I mean, I remember what we had prior to the passage of the Affordable Care Act and the protections embodied therein. People who were ill without insurance often put off care until things were pretty bad, and then would often present in hospital emergency rooms. They wouldn't be denied care, but those costs then went to the taxpayers. And we don't want to recreate that situation of really, a catastrophic care system. We want to encourage people to, have annual wellness checks and to be proactive about maintaining their good health.
Well, Senator Baldwin, thank you so much for joining me here on Lake Effect and taking the time to talk with me.
Well, I'm delighted to, and I hope your listeners will continue to follow this debate closely. It's going to impact everybody. Healthcare is a deeply personal issue, and I hope your listeners speak out as they learn more.
Democrat Tammy Baldwin is a junior senator from Wisconsin. She spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers, who reached her in Washington, D.C.
Coming up next, we'll hear a unique perspective about preparing for the Appalachian Trail. Lake Effect Weekend continues here on Milwaukee Public Radio.
We're back with Lake Effect Weekend on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. The Appalachian Trail runs 2,190 miles from Georgia all the way to the summit of Mount Katahdin in Maine. It takes months to complete and a good amount of preparation for novice and experienced hikers alike.
Milwaukee native Lauren Groh is embarking on that journey soon, and she is busy preparing all supplies she will need on the trail.
Today is a normal day like any other. Lauren woke up and fed the crying cats. She brewed a strong pot of coffee and ate her breakfast. She got dressed, slung her bag over her shoulder, clipped her name tag to her shirt, and went to work. Nothing out of the ordinary. Today is the last normal day of Lauren's 29-year-old Wisconsin life. Tomorrow, she will be jobless and slinging a much different bag over her shoulder. This new bag is blue, and it has all sorts of straps and buckles. Most importantly, the bag has a purpose: to keep Lauren alive. The blue bag's name is Zoe. There are a lot of other bags that look exactly like Zoe. In fact, Zoe has another name that the outdoorsy type might be familiar with, but she is called Zoe because she is personal to Lauren. Zoe has been put to the test many times. She's been on planes and subways and buses. She has seen four seasons, including one Wisconsin winter, which should have its own category. But Zoe is strong. Zoe is sturdy. She does her job well. She carries Keep Lauren Alive items like water, food, warm clothing, cooking supplies, shelter, first aid necessities, and navigational tools. In a few days, Zoe will be put to the ultimate test, a 2,000-mile journey on the Appalachian Trail. Of course, Zoe won't walk. Lauren will do the walking, and she'll carry Zoe on her back. In turn, Zoe will carry everything else. On the Appalachian Trail, it will be Zoe's job to protect Keep Lauren Alive items from blazing sun, whipping rain, bitter cold, and the horrendous stench of everything she carries. She will be with Lauren every step of the way, so she'll have to bear her stench too. Each night as Lauren camps, Zoe will relax. Lauren will empty everything out of Zoe and embark on a very short list of nightly responsibilities. Zoe will patiently wait for her next mission while Lauren and her hiking partner assemble their tent, cook and eat dinner, change into their pajamas, and turn in for the night. In the morning, the pair will complete similar responsibilities with the additional task of finding and filtering that day's water. When all that is done, Zoe will again become heavy with Keep Lauren Alive items, her next mission already underway. Lauren will strap Zoe to her back and hike away from camp, discussing that day's agenda with her hiking partner. Like Zoe's missions, the agenda is simple. Hike a certain number of miles to get to another camping spot. This routine will repeat itself for the next 6 months as Lauren walks north along a historical footpath through America's easternmost states, from Georgia to Maine. Zoe will cling to Lauren as she travels from town to town, while voluntarily fording ice-cold rivers, braving thunderstorms, and scaling mountains. When Zoe is around, Lauren often speaks of her upcoming trip on the Appalachian Trail. Fellow hikers wonder why Lauren is carrying Zoe, and why she walks with poles. People are curious and sometimes shocked to learn about this long-distance trail that thousands of people hike each year. Lauren explains that she feels privileged to have an opportunity to be in nature, doing what she loves all day, instead of being at work. With Zoe's help, Lauren will walk every last one of those 2,190 miles to her destination at the summit of Mount Katahdin in Maine. And with Lauren's help, Zoe will make it there too.
Lauren Groh is a Milwaukee native and Lake Effect contributor. We'll bring you a series of essays and interviews from Lauren as she hikes the Appalachian Trail in the months to come, so stay tuned.
Up next, we'll speak with a witness to a little-known chapter of history in southeastern Wisconsin, the presence of a German nationalist camp in 1941 Grafton. That's when Lake Effect returns, here on 89.7 WUWM. Take me home. Lake Effect Weekend continues on Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Nationalist and populist movements are on the rise across the world, from our presidential election in the United States to the recent Dutch election, in which voters turned out in record numbers that defeated populist leader Geert Wilders. People are watching this movement closely.
It was the late 1930s when the rise of nationalism in Germany gave rise to Adolf Hitler, the Nazi Party, and the so-called Third Reich.
That nationalist movement was not limited to Europe, however. It was supported by German immigrants and others of German descent around the world, including the U.S. In fact, southeastern Wisconsin was home to two camps run by a group of Nazi sympathizers called the German-American Bund.
Grafton was a town of little more than 1,000 residents and was where the Bund's camp Hindenburg was located. There are few people alive today who were there the day the Bund came to town, and it's a history few in the community still talk about.
But it's a day Skip Earnessy has not forgotten. He was 11 years old in 1941. We met him and the Grafton Historical Society's Nick Shannon in the Grafton Public Library, and Earnessy described what he saw.
Well, the thing I remember is that these Germans came marching up the street, and they had the German flags flying, and they were singing Deutschland, liebe alles, I think. And they were heading for the Grafton Hotel, where they usually held their meetings on Sundays. And because they had the German flags flying and their uniforms on us, it just so happened I was downtown at the time. A couple of us kids were down there, and we saw this, and we only had one police officer in Grafton at that time in 1941, and somehow the word got out that they were down there, the Germans, and quite a few people from the village were down there, too. And I don't know where they came from. I would almost assume they came out of Milwaukee, because there must have been at least 10 policemen all of a sudden there, and I don't know where they came from, but they made them take those German flags down, and they gave them an American flag, and they told them to get back to their camp, which was on the east side of the river at that time. And so they turned around, and they started walking up 12th Avenue here, right? Yeah, well, anyways, they came marching up this street right here past the where the library is now. Right there is where they threw the American flags down, and they put up their German flags again, and then they were singing their song and the rest of the way down to their camp, down to the river. And it was quite an exciting time for Grafton, you know, because we were a big village of about 1,100 people, which there's that many living on my block now, I think, the way the village is growing.
Well, and you were 11 years old. I imagine you kind of understood what's going on, but at the same time, this kind of thing doesn't happen in Grafton every day, even today.
Well, that's what I mean. It was really something, you know, something to see, and that's why I probably remember it too, because it certainly was. I didn't realize it at the time, of course, that it was quite a historical situation there.
Do you remember what, I don't know, your parents or the adults that you knew at that time thought of what was going on?
Well, I remember we were eating dinner on December 7th, when all of a sudden on the radio they announced that the Japanese had bombed Pearl Harbor and we were now at war. I really understood it after it got going, because, you know, being the size village we were, when the draft came on, well, they pretty much cleaned the town out of young guys. And my dad was a superintendent at Younger Stove and Range Company, which is an old company. And they had a government contract shortly after that for making parts for something, I don't know what it was, but in the foundry, because they had a gray iron foundry. And my dad had me working there in the summertime, and what always got me was I never could tell anybody how much I earned, because that was against the child labor laws or something, and my dad got paid in cash for me, and I got $5 a week, so I was the richest kid in Grafton.
You know, you talk about the Germans marching into town, but they had an ongoing summer camp here. What was the I guess atmosphere like between, you know, the kids like you who lived here and the people who came up, some of the kids who were up in town for that?
Well, that camp did split up. The camp on the east side of the river was on Jim Wigner's farm, and it was called the Carl Schurz German-American Camp, if I remember correctly. In fact, I think that camp or that organization is still someplace west of here. They told me on some lake or someplace. But the Bund, the Germans, the radicals, they moved out, and they moved to the west side of the river on the Grafton side. And that's what's River Park now. I do remember that, because on the Carl Schurz side, every summer the German these German, oh, I should say, yeah, well, they were German kids, but I mean, they were all out of Milwaukee. Those were all German families, and that was their place that for summer camp. And they had they built a long barracks there, and the kids would be there, and because they put a fence up in the middle of the dam, and that was our swimming hole when we were kids down here at Limekill Park. And they put a fence up in the middle of the dam and said that this was our side, that was their side, we should stay on our side, which didn't work. You know, you can't tell kids like us that. That's why I said we were the first. I was the first German prisoner of war.
Well, tell us that story. How did that happen?
Well, like I said, they told us to stay on our side of the fence. Well, one Sunday morning, Joe, my buddy, and I were down there swimming, and we didn't give a dang about that. So we were on the wrong side of the fence, and a couple of Germans came and grabbed us because we were on the wrong side of the fence. And we found out that Saturday, this was on Sunday morning, Saturday they had a big picnic there. And they gave us a stick with a nail in it and two Germans, one behind each of us. And they marched us through the park and we had to pick up all the papers and put it in bags. And we finally got out of there. And when I got home, like I said, it was Sunday. And I got home about 1:30, quarter to 2 in the afternoon. That's when we finally got out of there. And my dad, he laid into me. He says, you know, on Sundays, we eat dinner here at noon. I said, hey, Dad, the Germans wouldn't let us out of the camp. I said, we had to clean it up. You what? You know, he's hollered at me. He said, he was going to take care of that. Well, I don't know whatever happened about it, but I know he didn't. But that's why we said we were the first German prisoners of war. So, but they did split. And like I said, the Bund came on the east side of the river, and the German Americans stayed with it with their picnic grounds over the other side. And I gave them all that information as to who owned the land and who sold it and all that. Well, that's all in there. You know, all the paperwork. Well, Nick knows that too, yeah. So they got a pretty good history that I had obtained there from, Paul Knauer, his name was. And he lived down in the park down there. And he gave me all that information, and he died shortly after that too, so I was kind of glad he gave it to me.
Let me ask you this, Nick. How much do you think the people of Grafton today recognize about this period in the town's history?
Well, I don't think that the older people know all about the history of the Bund Camp in Grafton and what took place, especially shop owners. A very good local historian would have been Leroy Paulin, who owned Paulin's Market. So now there hasn't been so much talk about it. It's just been one of those things that it still is an active organization with private membership, but they don't talk about the past at all.
This does not hold the same place in Grafton history that the music industry did, for example.
Not one bit. We're very proud of the record factory here, made records, and you know, Grafton back then, we had all of the blues singers, black, come up from Milwaukee, down south, and everything was fine with that. But they were treated pretty good from what I understand, but not so much with the Bund Camp, especially as time kept progressing and things kept getting a little worse.
See, the problem with that question that you just asked is right now I can probably count on one hand the people that were born and raised in Grafton, old people. There's a lot of old people here, but they all moved in here because of the nice community and the facilities for them, and so they know nothing about this, you know. Anything that they probably read, they would know, but if you ask them a question about it, they say, Bund, what is that, you know.
Nick, your mom, if I remember correctly, you said your mother was born and raised here as well?
Yes, she was, and she grew up on 9th Avenue in Grafton.
Did she ever talk about this period?
She talked about knowing of it, but her parents were very protective of the kids. They would not, and being that they had five girls and only one boy, you know, they had to keep them at home. They would not let them run the town like Skip probably had free run of the town. Boys were different back then.
Let me ask you this, Nick, as someone who, you know, works to preserve history, do you think it's important to tell this particular story of Grafton's history? Do you think it fits some purpose for maybe kids today growing up knowing about this kind of darker period?
Well, being a local historian here, I believe it is good to record all history, whether, you know, because Grafton went from the lake all the way over to Cedarburg, from Port down to Mequon, and our history was Yulyo Station, Port Yulyo. You need to preserve that, and as long as you're telling the truth about the history, it should be kept and made of record. And if some people don't like that, well, this is the way it was. This is what honestly did take place. And that's why we are always trying to interview older people and get their thoughts on what it was like growing up in Grafton.
You know, even considering that period, was Grafton a good place to grow up? I mean, obviously you stayed.
Oh, I think so, yes. In fact, I miss the small community. We're a pretty good-sized community now, as you know. I mean, it's growing by leaps and bounds, and I think it's growing way too fast. But after the war was over, and all the guys were back from the service and everything, Seth Liebenstein lived next door to me, and he was in the Marines during the war, and he was over in the Philippines. And they were being bombed one day, and he said he dove into a foxhole. And I forget where he said the guy that was, the other Marine that was in there, but they got talking to each other, trying to calm themselves down, he said. And this Marine asked Seth, you know, where are you from? And he said, well, he said, I live in Grafton, Wisconsin. He says, hey, that's where the Bund is, isn't it? So apparently Grafton was quite notorious for that very reason. And whether that's good or bad, I don't know, but it's one of the things that we're known for. Whether we want to be known for it or not, it's history. So that shows you how far the word was around even during the war.
Yes, and during the wartime, there was a lot of support by all of the manufacturing in Grafton here. I know on both sides of my family, there was everybody was in the service. My ma did not go, and neither did one of her sisters, but they worked at a place on the east side of the river, north of the Highway 60 bridge. It was called Zones, and they made submachine gun parts during the war, and so that was their effort. And then she did have another sister, two sisters, one was a Wave and one was a Whack, and then my dad and three of his brothers were all in the Army. But everybody was making something for the war effort.
It sounds like even you.
Yeah, they were making parts for the what the parts were for. I don't know, but I did learn something there though. I knew that I was never ever going to work in a foundry again, because at that time I was shifting weights and that core gas was enough. I said I'd rob banks or do anything, but I'm not going back in a foundry.
And my dad, who worked at Grobe Incorporated down here, at that time it was Grobe Brothers when they started off right by the railroad tracks here in town. He worked there 44 years. And he remembered, and he told me this, that there was one German man from the Bund camp that would walk up, and because it wasn't that far of a walk, maybe a mile, and work at Grobe, and he was kind of kept to himself, eating lunch and that, and then he'd go back. And so that was one guy that was there and was employed, did good work at Grobe, but just didn't associate with too many other people. And like with my ma, being a girl in the family, all the girls, their mother and father were very protective. As soon as they got wind that the people from the Bund were up in town, everybody kind of gathered their kids in a little bit because you did not know what's going to happen next.
It sounds like in the end it was still peaceful, but
yes.
That wasn't a given.
Yeah, it was peaceful, but you did not know. So to be on the safe side, they were very protective.
As someone who works to preserve history, it has to be important that there are still guys like Skip out there who remember this time.
Oh, I am so glad that I was able to hook up with Skip, because when John from the library here called me and said BBC would like to do something on Bund camps in America, well, you know, nobody wants to cause anybody trouble. We just want to preserve history. And John checked with me, and I thought, oh, Skip is the first one that comes to my mind. I mean, there are many, but they're all passed already. But Skip, and he has a very good mind. He's very sharp, and he lived that time period at a good age when things were memorable. So I'm grateful for Skip, and I wish that there could be a few more. I do have one other name that I'm trying to get who actually owned the cottage down there afterwards, but she's not doing well right now.
Well, Skip, we're grateful you're here too, and that you're able to share these stories with us.
Well, I'm kind of happy about it myself, really. I never really gave that a thought as far as the history of Grafton, and being a part of it was, I guess, a privilege for me to be able to still be here on this earth, you know. Yes. And thank God that the adage of only the good die young, otherwise I'd be a long time gone already.
Well, Skip, Nick, thank you both so much.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mitch.
86-year-old Skip Ernesee is a lifelong resident of Grafton and was 11 years old on the day that the German-American boom marched into the center of town. Nick Shannon is with the Grafton Historical Society. We spoke with them at a USS Liberty Memorial Public Library in Grafton. You can find a link to more about the phenomenon of German boom camps at WUWN.com.
We'll take one last break and then return with our storytelling series, Ex Fabula. You're listening to 89.7 WUWN.
And then it occurred to me, what luck.
Okay.
I
so,
swore a solemn
my family
vow.
Really
years ago,
intense
I was invited to a party.
Totally different.
But I never been
from a large Irish, Italian, Catholic family.
Welcome again to another episode of Ex Fabula Radio on Lake Effect Weekend here on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Rachel Owens in the studio with Ex Fabula co-founder Leah Delaney. Hello.
Well, hello to you, Rachel. How are you?
Doing pretty well. Quite the busy festive weekend we're having here in Milwaukee.
I know. Basketball, St. Patrick's Day, all that good stuff. Everything happening at once, basically.
Absolutely. And of course, luck is on the minds of many this weekend.
Yes, due to the holiday season of St. Patrick's Day. Our theme for the show today is luck of the draw. Do you have any big plans this weekend?
Going to see some roller derby Saturday night.
Okay, that has nothing to do with being Irish, but I totally respect that.
I'll be wearing shamrock socks, so that's my contribution.
Okay. Well, there we go. Much better. Well, today I brought a couple of stories revolving around the theme of luck. So let's us dive straight in. Our first story comes from our first season back in 2010, when the theme was actually luck, believe it or not. Here's a story from Drew Braille.
I should not be here tonight. I should be dead. I was in the luckiest accident in automotive history. And this is how it happened. Years ago, I was invited to a party, and a friend of mine, whom I'll call Julius, swung by my house to pick me up to drive me there. I didn't know how to drive yet, which is important, as you'll see later. So we're driving down the freeway to this party, and we get into a conversation, and the subject kind of wanders onto how we both have this amused contempt for small talk, and how some people feel the need to fill a perfectly good silence with meaningless, empty words, and how we're both trying to break ourselves of this habit. We were both freshmen in college at the time. So we make our point, and we lapse into a kind of smug silence for the next couple of miles, because nobody's going to break it, you see, because that would be weak. Now, before I forget, I should tell you that I have no idea where this party is or how to get there. I'm entirely relying on Julius to know the way. So after a couple more minutes of this, I decide to be the big man, and I say, "Why, we sure are getting good at avoiding small talk, aren't we?" And Julius says nothing. So I think, okay, this is the way he's going to play this, huh? So I shut up again and smile for another couple of miles, and we're driving down the freeway, and finally I get fed up, and I throw up my hands, and I say, "Okay, Julius, you win. You're better at silence than I am." And he still says nothing, just keeps driving, looking straight ahead. In fact, it's not until after we get off the freeway and then get right back on the freeway And I ask him, Julius, are you sure you know where we're going? And he still doesn't say anything that I begin to suspect that something might be wrong. Or I'm just getting pissed off. I can't remember which. Now, what I didn't know at the time, what Julius himself didn't know at the time, is that Julius has epilepsy. And he's having what the doctors call a brownout. He's not a blackout. He's still conscious. He just isn't quite all there. He's driving perfectly normally. He's staying within the lines, going the speed limit, obeying all the other rules of traffic, but he just doesn't have any idea where he's going or why, and he obviously doesn't have any interest in conversation. But I can't tell, because aside from getting off and on the freeway, he's driving perfectly normally. I don't know where we're going, and because we've had this conversation, I think he's just being a jerk. So I don't panic, which is important. So eventually we get off the freeway again, and now we're in city traffic, and it's night, it's dark, and there's a big intersection, and there's a red light ahead of us, and there's a car stopped at that red light straight ahead of us, and there's another vehicle in the lane to our right. And Julius, brownout or no, can see the red light, knows it means stops, put his foot on the brake, but he doesn't put it on quite vigorously enough, and we rear end the car in front of us at the intersection. A little. So here's the luckiest accident in automotive history. We rear-end the car in front of us, but one, nobody gets hurt. Two, the car in front of us is so little damaged that when the light turns green, the driver just drives off. He never gets out of the car to swap insurance numbers. Three, the car that Julius is driving is damaged in just such a way that when the light turns green and he puts his foot on the gas, because he's still not reacting to anything, and now I'm really starting to freak out, he puts his foot on the gas, the car won't start. Must have dislodged the flenser valve or something. And four, the vehicle in the lane to our right, remember, is an ambulance. So the EMTs pile out of the car and they check to see if everybody's all right and notice that something's seriously out of whack with Julius, and they shine lights in his eyes and give him orange juice and restore him and generally save the day. So let's take stock. One, if Julius had had a blackout on the freeway instead of a brownout, death. Two, if we hadn't had this conversation or I knew where we were going and I had realized that something was seriously wrong and had panicked, remember I don't drive, trying to grab the wheel or do the brakes or something, death. If he had not put on the brakes at all and just rear-ended the car ahead of us, possibly death. If the car had been able to go when the light turned green, off we go into city traffic, death, possibly multiple deaths. But nobody gets killed, nobody gets hurt. Julius is diagnosed and treated, is never put in this situation again or puts anybody else in this situation again. As far as I'm concerned, the ambulance and lane to our right is just fortunate icing on a very lucky cake.
And that was Drew Brail's intense story from a story slam that we had back in 2010 at Moe's Irish Pub.
Ooh, that kind of gives me goosebumps listening to that, because it was such a great story. And you think, wow, how many times were you in a situation where if you had known at the time what the danger was, you would have been freaking out. But luckily, he didn't know. And that was helpful in that situation.
Most definitely. Speaking of being lucky, all of our members, our Xfabula members, are extremely lucky because we have another event coming up strictly free for them. It's a Secret Fabula event, and I know that we've talked about this in the past. These are specific events that we hold at different locations all over in Milwaukee. The next one's going to be at the UWM Planetarium, which happens to be one of my favorite places in the universe. No pun or maybe pun intended. I love that place. I used to take first dates there to see how they would react to like sitting and listening to lectures on the stars, because I'm a big constellation fan. And the one date that I took there, I fell asleep. So that was kind of interesting. But you, as a member, or if you want to buy tickets to come to this particular event, you'll be able to hear stories from the staff and volunteers that work for the UWM Planetarium. There'll be light refreshments. It'll be a really, really great time. And it's going to be on March 27th. So we'll give you details about that later and how to get those tickets. But speaking of dates, let's move into our next story. This one comes from no stranger to the Xfabula stage, Anjana Tanja, who tells her Risking It story from 2016 Story Slam.
Even though my doctor had told me to treat yourself like a diabetic, always bring food with you no matter where you go, I was like, no, I am not going to cook myself some fresh liver and avocado sprinkled with seaweed because I am tired of cooking for myself and my many unreasonable needs because I have over 35 food allergies. I cannot eat anything that I make unless I make myself, and I need a break from this because I want to be cool, and also because somehow I ended up with a date even though I live in Franklin with my parents, the suburbs, without a car. I'm 25 and I have no income. So before my date, I had a rigorous dance rehearsal with a dancer friend, and I'm not a dancer, but I danced and danced and danced with her, and then I was all, you know, really fluid of movement and spirit, and I met up with this guy who I really wasn't that into, but, you know, you take what you can get when you live with your parents, and I had been communicating with him on Facebook. I didn't really know him. I met him up with him at Rochambeau. And a transference occurred in which I could see the love gaze leaving his eyes, entering mine, and exiting mine towards him with a renewed and ever-growing fervor. And so then, you know, I'm getting really hungry, and I mention it, and he says, should I cook you an egg? And I was like, oh, I would love an egg, except I can't, because I can only have a duck egg if it's from a farm where it's been eating grass, because that's what my doctor told me to do, because I have over 35 intense food allergies. And he said, okay, never mind. So my mom comes to pick me up after the date, and by that time, I'm shaking, and I just shake more and more as we get the half hour to home. And so I'm like cutting up onions, I'm throwing it in the pan, and I'm feeling really quavery. And next thing you know, nothing. I open up my eyes, and it's dark. I'm in the back of an EMT vehicle, and they tell me, you had a seizure. And the thought is so horrifying. I've never had anything terrible medical happen to me like that before. I just fainted again. And because I can't even look at my skin, honestly, when I get a paper cut, I have someone else go, can you look at this? Am I bleeding? But anyways, so I wake up in the hospital, and I'm ravenous. I'm so hungry. My entire core just is aching with emptiness. I could just about eat the bed sheet, but they told me not to eat anything because they have to run some blood tests, and I'm crying. I'm so hungry, and I have a goose egg on the back of my head from where I thunked my head on the floor when I fainted and had a seizure. And so finally, my mom runs home and gets me some food because she is the one person in the world who knows what I can eat because I have so many food allergies. So she runs home, and they run the tests on me. She brings back this food for me, and it's the duck egg I was cooking, but it's covered in hairs, and it's covered in grit because apparently when I had flipped it, it went all over the floor as I fainted. And she just rinsed it in the sink. And I ate it. I devoured it. I was so hungry. I was just tearfully eating. And it wasn't delicious, but it was so satisfying. And after that, I got in contact with the guy, and he never contacted me again, really. But, like, you know, sometimes I'd send him Facebook messages, and I'd feel hypoglycemic. And now I know how to gauge if someone is good for me or not on if I start to feel hypoglycemic in their presence. Because I've never had a situation like this occur to me ever again, and I know how not to risk it.
And that was Anjana Tanja telling us her risking it story under the theme of luck today.
Certainly a positive twist at the end. You always have to listen to your body, right?
Yes, yeah. Intuition, Body signals. Yes, we're all animals when it comes down to it, aren't we?
I think so, absolutely. So you're going to tell us a little bit more about that Secret Fabula event happening.
Yes, yes. The Secret Fabula event, again, is going to be at the UWM Planetarium on March 27th. You can get all the details, including tickets, on our website, which is xfabula.org. You can also find information on our final story slam coming up before we hit the All-Stars. And you know, when we do, we have these monthly story slams, we get an audience favorite. We take all of those audience favorites, stick them on stage, in a big stage, and we ask them to tell a little bit longer of a story, up to 10 minutes. And then we have the grand finale storyteller of the season. And I have to tell you, we had an event last week on Wednesday, and it was at the Time Cinema, and the theme was acquired taste. And Joel Dreising told a story, and he won the audience's hearts that night. So he'll be moving on, and we'll have one more spot left, and that's going to be at our April event, and it's revolving around the theme of Milwaukee. It's going to be a really special event, so we'll have more details about that further into the weeks coming up.
So it's kind of like you have your own tournament bracket going on.
Yeah, we do. Good one, Rachel.
Thank you. Thank you. I was trying to tie it in somehow.
Nicely done. But you can get all the details about becoming a member, about our XFabula specific member events or workshops, Secret Fabulas or slams, blah, 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 blah. Everything at xfabula.org.
Well, as always, it's so much fun. Thanks again, Leah.
Thanks a lot, Rachel. Have a great weekend.
You too.
X Fabula is a regular feature on Lake Effect Weekend, and it wraps up the show for today. I'm Audrey Nowakowski.
And I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for making us a part of your afternoon. Lake Effect Weekend airs every Saturday and Sunday from 3 to 4, and be sure to tune into the weekday version of this show at 10 in the morning.
That's all on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned now for Weekend All Things Considered coming up next. It's 4 o'clock.